This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 16, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, electrical engineer and Tesla technologist, Thomas Imlauer, as well as a trialogue with musician and former director of Borderlands Research Foundation, Michael Thoreau. Rejoining me this week as co-host is musician and generalist Alex Fulton. On this episode, we delve into questions surrounding alternative sciences, specifically as they relate to energy, communications, and biology. Although both my guests approach these subject matters from different avenues, they seem to converge on a common theme, that space and time are not what we think they are. While each explores the so-called etheric dimension for different purposes, we can ascertain from their conjunctive works that space itself is quite possibly a highly exotic medium which carries all manner of so-called paranormal forces. And time, as hinted at by the time-reverse symmetry of microphysical laws, may be nothing but a persistent epiphenomenal illusion. However, where space ends and time begins remains an open question. Thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. Joining us today on Pentimental is Michael Thoreau. Michael is the former director of Borderlands Research Foundation, taking over the position from Thomas Joseph Brown in the mid-1990s. He's a former radar technician, presently plays as a professional musician, and has composed several monographs on the subjects of acoustical science, etheric physics, mysticism, radionics, and bioinformatics. Thank you for being with us today, Michael.
It's great to be here.
And joining me as co-host is our good friend Alex Fulton. Thanks for helping out, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, can you maybe introduce yourself a little more in depth and what your background is?
Oh, well, I thought that was pretty good.
There has to be something you can elaborate on. Where did you come from?
Well, it's kind of interesting how I got involved in all of this. I just got out of the Marine Corps, and I was working in the high desert, Joshua Tree, to be specific, in California. And I had somehow run into a guy who was doing work as a private investigator. And he was looking into the disappearance of a girl at the Joshua Tree National Monument. And he suggested that I work with him. And one of the places that he was suspicious of was this place called the Integratron, which is out in Landers, California. The Integratron was developed by George Van Tassel back in the 60s and 70s. It's a place out in Landers near this site called Giant Rock. Anyway, there were a number of abandoned car vehicles on the property, and he thought that something fishy was going on there, so he wanted me to investigate the site. So I went out there and I talked to the caretaker of the site at the time, and he showed me around. He showed me the building called the Integratron. And currently at that time, it was being worked on by some people that he referred to as borderland scientists. And I didn't know anything about borderland sciences at the time. So anyway, we parted ways at some point, and there was that borderland sciences thing was kind of left in my memory. I moved to San Diego and started working in a restaurant there. I was 22 years old, and I get a call from this private investigator, and he says, oh, you know what? Borderland Sciences headquarters is somewhere in Southern California in North County, San Diego, and I need you to go check them out because I think there's something fishy going on there. And I said, really? So I looked up Borderland Sciences, and it just happened to be two blocks away from where I was living at the time. And so I called the number and Tom Brown answered. And I said, hey, can I come on over and talk to you about all this stuff? Now, early on, I was very interested in the topics that Borderlands, I didn't really know a lot about Borderlands at the time, but I was kind of interested in the ideas that they were, you know, presenting through the journal. I'd looked at a couple of journals, but what kind of drew me to that was in the 70s as a kid, I was kind of infatuated with the series In Search Of that was hosted by Leonard Nimoy. And one of the shows that he had done was on Coral Castle in Rockgate, Florida. And this guy named Edward Leedscallon, who had built this incredible castle and a number of different things that were made out of like giant 30 ton blocks of coral. And somehow, and he was 120 pounds and soaking wet. And he somehow managed to put these blocks of coral into configurations where he had revolving doors that you could push open with one finger and a number of things. And I'm sure everybody's heard about Coral Castle, but what was interesting to me was that he had written a book called Magnetic Current. And when I went to see Tom, and I just walked over there because I was only two blocks away, I found it really interesting that he knew what I was talking about and we had a lot of the same ideas about things. And he asked me if I wanted to start working there, which was great. And I said, sure, I can do some part-time work for you. And one of the things that he wanted me to do was go through the book library. He had recently taken over Borderlands Sciences from Riley Crabb, who ran the foundation from 1959 to 1985. And Borderlands Sciences was founded by Mead Lane in 1945, and Riley took over in 59. Anyway, Tom had just taken over, and he wanted me to go through the library and start alphabetizing things because it was in total disarray. And I remember it so distinctly because it was happened to be my birthday, and I'm going through the books, and I'm on this giant ladder because these bookshelves were probably 13 feet high, something like that. And I pull a book out, and I'm going to move it, you know, as I'm cataloging all these books, and a book falls to the floor face up, and it's Magnetic Current by Edward Leedscallon. I nearly fell off the ladder, of course. And I got this book, and I said, look, Tom, here's the book that I was telling you about. It was in the library the whole time. So that's not really telling you about myself, but that's kind of an introduction on how I got to know Tom Brown and get interested in Borderlands Sciences. And then eventually he said, well, we're moving the entire operation from San Diego to Northern California. And would you like to come with us and work with us? And I did. And eventually I became the director in 1995 and Tom moved to New Zealand. So it was quite a strange trip.
So that was a pretty striking example of synchronicity, I would say.
Oh, yes.
Do you notice a lot of that as a person?
I notice it all the time. Not necessarily every day, but I mean, it happens all the time. And it's something that I've learned to go with over the years.
So you've written a number of really good monographs. The probably longest one, maybe I'm mistaken, is The Formative Forces of Music. So can you tell us a little bit about what that work is and what you were trying to accomplish in it?
Well, the title of the book is The Rhythmic Formative Forces of Music. The rhythmic part is very important to what I was trying to convey in the book. I became interested in Trevor James Constable's work with weather engineering. And I talked to Trevor a number of times and tried to, you know, get information out of him about how he was doing what he was doing. And he would usually refer me to some book by either Rudolf Steiner or something in the Steiner press or in the Anthroposophic press about, you know, the etheric formative forces. And one book in particular was called The Etheric Formative Forces in Cosmos, Earth, and Man by Gunter Voxmuth. And so I got a hold of this book and read it and then reread it and then reread it again. And I'm still not understanding, but I'm starting to get an idea of what he's doing. And then being a musician, I kind of always had to relate, especially in this case, this type of etheric science to music, because in Steiner's anthroposophic, what would you call it, in his anthroposophic science, if you will, he had the idea that the foundation of the sciences and of nature came from the four ethers. And one of those four ethers, and they kind of coincide with the four elements, but one of the four ethers was called the chemical ether or the tone ether, and Trevor Constable talked about it repeatedly. And so I kind of hooked into that idea that Steiner was presenting with this chemical ether and how that related to nature and how it related to weather specifically, because we were talking about weather modification. Of course, Constable originally studied Wilhelm Reich and Reich's invention of the cloudbuster before he arrived at Steiner's work, and then combined Steiner's work with Reich's work, which was quite a great match. In any case, I would look at that and I would see it was also called, the chemical ether was also called the tone ether. And I was trying to figure out, well, why was it called the tone ether? Well, because the atmosphere is the medium through which sound travels through. So Steiner related it to that. So then I could therefore relate it to how music interacts with that chemical ether. And so the book is really an outgrowth of that. And there's so many more things in the book that relate to anthroposophic science that go beyond just the weather engineering side of things. It could get into homeopathy, for instance, the science of homeopathy and potentization and peripheral forces that are involved with the creation of homeopathic remedies. And that there's some of that in the book too, but there's a rhythmic element that is infused throughout all of that work. And that's what I really tried to focus upon.
Well, something else that I'm a bit interested in is mostly people think of them as anti-gravity machines or free energy machines or what have you. But regardless of if any of that works or not, or what exists and what doesn't, the physics of that seems to have a sort of musical current running underneath it. And it seems like it's a creative, technological, and theoretical field, if nothing else. And that's kind of why it keeps appealing to me in these sorts of ideas that also tie in older ideas of what people had either been revealed and put in mythologies or what have you. It seems like we're finding new stuff in the old all the time.
Yeah, well, when I was at Borderlands, I was introduced to the work of Dale Pond in sympathetic vibratory physics, and he was working along those lines with the possibility of using that for some kind of propulsion, I mean, a number of things. But I didn't get too far into that. I had always looked at music, being a musician, as something that I could create as an art form, and using time as the canvas in which to create that art was really paramount to me. I mean, I wanted to create musical compositions that affected people in certain ways. And I've done a lot of work in that area. I wasn't so much looking at music and the creation of physical things based on vibrations as much as I was looking at it from a compositional standpoint, compositionally creating things. And in the book, Rhythmic Formative Forces, I included a small work by Margaret Watts Hughes entitled The Idaphone Voice Figures. And what she had done was, rather than the simple Schlenny figures that people are familiar with, where you sprinkle lycopodium powder on a plate and then run a violin bow against it, or there's greater technologies than that these days. But that was the early vision that these people had, was to create patterns on this plate based on different notes that they could actually induce into the plate. And, you know, that would obviously bring up, you know, certain frequencies and what is actual natural pitch that people use to tune their instruments and music and all kinds of other things. But getting back to that, Margaret Watts Hughes took it a step further, and she took mixtures and made them into a liquid form and then suspended that liquid between plates and then put that on a drum head basically and sang into that. And so she could, by her compositions and what she was singing, actually create what appeared to be living forms as opposed to just geometric patterns on a plate. So she was creating branching trees and plant forms and a number of things, but they were more, it seemed like they were more of a living nature than just simple patterns.
That kind of brings to mind, there's this quote that I like from Michael Jackson, of all people, where he says, "Deep inside, I feel that this world we live in is really a big, huge, monumental symphonic orchestra. I believe that in its primordial form, all of creation is sound, and that it's not just random sound, but it's music," which I thought was a beautiful sort of encapsulation of, I think, this idea. And it also kind of brings to mind various creation myths, of, particularly in the C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, where Aslan, the great lion, creates Narnia by vocalizing things and bringing them into being and brings in the trees. And it's exactly what you're describing.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's actually, you know, in the beginning was the word, and it's a vibration, and, you
exactly,
know,
it, yeah.
But so I see it more as a, it becomes a more complex composition. So I started to study classical music early in my career as a musician, and I started out with Bach and Vivaldi and Telemann and all of the great Baroque masters. And I was also looking at electrical theory at the time, working at Borderland Sciences. And I was also introduced to Eric Dollar at the time, who was a brilliant electrical engineer. And he said that he learned everything he knew about electricity from listening to Bach. So I had to figure that out. And I read his four quadrant theory of electricity and I started to understand what he was talking about. But then later on, the problem with that is you're talking about music that's kind of dimensional, but it's more linear in fashion, and it doesn't play a lot with time. Time becomes very strict in those contrapuntal compositions of Bach. The other thing was is that that also brought up the idea of how Bach was able to modulate between keys in his music. And the reason for that, it was because about that time, they were able to falsify the piano forte in its tuning so that you could play in a number of keys. So they went from just intonation to equal temperament. In order to do that, they had to falsify the thirds and the fifths on the piano. So the thirds were widened and the fifths were narrowed. And then everything, if you hadn't been listening to just intonation for years and years, your ear would be tricked into thinking everything was okay. Well, what happened over a couple of centuries is that our ears became accustomed to equal temperament. And you find that instruments like the guitar with its frets and the piano and any number of instruments are equally tempered. So they're all falsified in their intervallic relationships as far as the major scale is concerned. And you get into Eastern music, you don't see that because most of the instruments don't have frets on them. It's a very melodic form of music. We hear microtonal intervals. But aside from that, I started to listen to 20th century musicians and their compositions, and they started playing with time. And what they were trying to do, they were doing things like micro counterpoint, where the interval relationships between the two different melodies were so close together that you didn't really feel that there was this linear thing going on. What was going on was more of a vertical thing, or almost a standing wave analogy. And composers like Gheorghe Ligeti, Olivier Messiaen, these guys were doing incredible things with music. And then along came Frank Zappa.
That damn Zappa.
And, you know, I got into Zappa like probably everyone else does, you know, listening to the Mothers of Invention and hearing some of the stuff that was really cool. And then all of a sudden you hear this weird composition that's going here and it's going there and it's going up and it's going down and it's sideways. And I'm going, what is he doing? And so I got into his orchestral compositions, and unbelievable, really unbelievable what a genius he was. And to this day, I mean, there was another guy who composed, but he didn't have the compositional agility of Zappa, and that was Captain Beefheart.
Oh, yeah.
And that guy was just absolutely, he was even further on, in my opinion, because he played with rhythms and combined rhythms in such a way that you didn't even know it was music you were listening to. It was almost like an ayahuasca trip.
Yeah. I had a class in college of, it was actually on the Beatles with this professor who was, he was a doctor of music theory and very intelligent, but he would always get crap from his peers in the music department because, oh, he teaches that rock and roll music. And he said that to play with those people, he would play them Trout Mask Replica, the Captain Beefheart record, and say, listen to this, because this is just as complex and just, I don't know how to describe it really, but.
Oh, it was, Trout Mask Replica was incredibly complex. You know, the early roots of Beefheart was kind of he was doing a blues thing, and he even had Ry Cooder in his band for a while playing guitar, and it was a bluesy kind of thing. But everybody talked about the British invasion and all these guys, you know, from Clapton to Jeff Beck and Pete Townsend even, and all of these guys that were playing the blues like the original American blues guys were doing. And, you know, they kind of had it. They had something there. But then when you go back and you listen to Beefheart in, like, say, 1967, he was doing exactly, he got it. And then he just kind of gradually went on from there. And, you know, everybody says the pinnacle was Trout Mask Replica. In my opinion, it was an album called Shiny Beast, which was later renamed Bat Chain Puller. And there was some issue that they had with Warner Brothers where they had to rename the thing. But it was Bat Chain Puller and that song Bat Chain Puller. There are things going on in there. I mean, part of the main theme he got from listening to the rain hitting his windshield on this crappy car he had, and the wipers were making this particular noise. And there's this ostinato thing going on in the background of windshield wipers played by a guitar. And then he added all these other things, and he didn't know how to write music. He didn't know any of that. But when you put some of his compositions up to some of the greatest 20th century composers, you go, well, it doesn't matter if you know all of that stuff.
Yeah. In some ways, it kind of makes things difficult to know. Like, I mean, he just did that on a feeling rather than a kind of learned thing. If you know what I mean?
Right. And, you know, you don't have to read music to be able to play music and experience music. Mm-hmm. The academic world would have you believe that, oh, you have to learn this way to play music. And it's really, I played with a lot of musicians, and there are some that have come from that academic training that are very, very good, but there's a good portion of them that can only do what they've been taught. And that goes along with anything that you do. You know, I remember when I was in the Marine Corps and they taught me how to fix radars. That's all I knew how to do. I didn't really understand electronics. They taught me specifically to fix this certain piece of gear, and that was it. And you know, a lot of that comes out of academia.
Maybe we can talk about Reich and Trevor Constable for a few minutes. What was the Cloudbuster, in your opinion? Well, like, who made it succeed, and then who was Trevor Constable, and how did he build off the work of Reich?
Can you rephrase that?
I'm sorry. Like, okay, so Reich had the Cloudbuster, right? Wasn't he that idea? And then isn't arguably what Trevor Constable was doing was a similar thing?
It was. Trevor Constable relied more on Steiner's concept of the ethers than he did on Reich's concept of the orgone at a certain point. And when I first started down that path, I built a Reich Cloudbuster, and it was a monster. And I did a lot of experimentation with it. Nothing like Dr. James DeMeo has done, and I'm saying his name because if anybody's interested in that, that would be the guy who has actually followed Reich's work and recreated it. He would be the one to check out. But Trevor went down a different path with the anthroposophic work of Steiner and created. And so in Reich's Cloudbuster, you have a number of tubes that are connected to a flexible tubing that has to go into some kind of water source, preferably a running water source. And certainly I noticed this, and I'm sure Reich did, that, you know, there's a a huge electrostatic charge that develops on this instrument when you're using it. So there, you know, and there was a lot of talk about how the orgone, and it was bluish in color, which is the same thing that Steiner was talking about with the chemical ether, but that there was an electrostatic element to it, or that it was just electrostatic, an electrostatic condition. The same thing with the orgone accumulator. What you had with an orgone accumulator is layers of inorganic and organic material layered together. And really what you were looking at was a capacitor. And any kind of atmospheric electricity would certainly be built up inside of an orgone accumulator. So there was that comparison, whether or not it's actually something measurable like electrostatic energy or it was the orgone. Nobody's really, as far as I understand, nobody's really come to any conclusion on that. But when you get into Steiner's four ethers and you get into the chemical ether specifically, then you're talking about something slightly more esoteric. And what Trevor did is he was able to remove the grounding. So you didn't have all of these giant cables going to a grounded water source anymore. He was able to create devices that existed within pure ether or pure space. And then he realized that, well, what they really needed to have to excite the ether was some kind of motion going on. So I talked to him quite a bit about it, looked at all of the photographs, understood some of the concepts that the devices were built according to the principles of, you know, sacred geometry, and created what I thought was close to what the work that he was doing. And I got some very good results with it in an experiment that I did in northern North Dakota back in 1987. And I had left Borderlands for a short time, moved back to North Dakota, and was still working and doing experiments and doing things. And I was working on this farm doing these experiments, wrote an article about it, sent it back to Tom Brown in California, and he published it. And Trevor called him up after he read it, and he said, how does this guy know all this stuff? And, well, he was the one who told me to look into Günter Wachsmuth and etheric formative forces, and he told me to read everything I could on Steiner. And if you do that, you're going to arrive at the technology. Now, so people ask me, well, why don't you just, like, tell everybody how it's done? And, you know, people have asked Trevor that. People asked James DeMeo that. It's, you know, I can tell you all day long how to build this equipment. It doesn't mean you're going to be able to modify the weather. But if you read Etheric Formative Forces in Cosmos, Earth, and Man, you will probably get a good idea of how to do it.
You mentioned sacred geometry, and I kind of wanted to bring it back to music a little bit. That there's kind of lately been a real push about the tunings of instruments these days, and how we've all been inundated and to the 440 hertz tuning, and lots of people saying we need to tune down to 432 to align ourselves with the cosmic, I don't know what you would call it, alignments. And so I just was wondering what your thoughts were on that issue.
Well, I've actually written about that a little bit, and it doesn't really make any difference whether it's 440 or 430, in my opinion. If I'm playing in a band and we're all playing in 430, it's more pleasing to my ear. Whether or not it's more cosmically in tune, the demonstration would be that you would take a plate and you'd put some kind of powder on it, and you would hook a transducer up to it, and you would play 440 hertz, and you get this chaotic pattern, right? This has been the demonstration. And then you put 432 into the same apparatus, and all of a sudden the pattern looks geometrically perfect. Well, if I alter that plate, I can make 440 hertz create the same pattern that the 432 hertz tone created on there. So there's a lot of factors involved in that that aren't necessarily correct. As a matter of fact, 440 was settled upon within the last century, I would say.
Right. There seems to be a lot of people saying, kind of bringing conspiratorial hypotheses in, saying that we've been deliberately forced to tune our instruments that way because it has a negative effect on consciousness. I don't know what, if you buy that or not.
I've heard that. I don't agree with it at all, but it's interesting. 440 Hertz was not, you know, they actually throughout history, if you look at it, you will see that it went all the way up to, I think, even 467 Hertz for A. And then they brought it down and then they brought it down. And it's just interesting that it just feels better at 432 Hertz, especially if you're listening to a classical composition on period instruments. It sounds fantastic. And I'm not sure that anybody's given a real good explanation of why that is. I mean, they've tried to show it, you know, using a quantitative analogy with the plates and the powder and the frequencies induced into the plate, but I don't think that that's really proven anything yet. Mm-hmm. But most people say 432 Hertz is more pleasing. And so I like to play using 432 Hertz. If I'm playing at a place and they bring a piano in, the piano is generally tuned to a real piano is generally tuned to 440. So I can't have somebody come in and retune it. So it makes things difficult, but so sometimes I have to play in 440, but I prefer to play in 432. That's about all I got on that subject.
fair enough.
Are you aware of Paul Laviolette?
I am. I really haven't looked into his work much, but I am aware of him.
Well, you mentioned a standing wave early on, and his basic framework is built around the standing wave model of the proton and neutron, and it's a constant creation cosmology kind of thing. But it's based on systems theory and self-organization, open systems, like Prigogine stuff. And I think it's a really, because he spoke of the chemical ether, and he models his as a kinetic, etheric type body. So he has to put forward some postulates, but it's a pretty interesting idea. It's always been the most attractive to me. So that blends into this chemical ether idea, whether the same thing or not, I'd leave that for you to decide, but it's an interesting correlation nonetheless.
Yeah. From a basic understanding of it, it sounds to me like he's looking at the same thing. See, here's the thing, and I believe this in a lot of, we'll call it alternative science, is that a number of people are coming up with the same thing at the same time. And then they're giving it their own name and they're using the more mechanistic terms that academic science has handed down to explain a lot of the same things. And I don't really have a problem with that. A lot of people seem to have a problem with that and understanding. And maybe it's because there are some people that are less educated into mechanistic science or quantitative science than they are the qualitative sciences. But I think we're kind of speaking about the same things. You know, there's zero point energy, there's scalar waves, there's standing waves. I've seen a number of things represented on, let's say, one side, on the anthroposophic side of things, that's looking at nature and actually explaining things in a completely different fashion than would an academic who's been through the quantitative science teachings. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that while I haven't leaned towards that quantitative side, more on the qualitative side, I've always been kind of a proponent of taking the two together and putting them together in any way that we can. Certainly when the research that I did with plants was like that, because I had to try to figure out how I was going to do experiments that would show that plants had a certain sentience. And I mean, this goes back to Clive Baxter and polygraph experiments with plants. And then later on, L. George Lawrence, instead of just having a strip chart recorder with galvanic skin response reactions of plants being represented on that strip chart recorder, L. George Lawrence took that a step further and took the galvanic skin response and hooked it to an audio oscillator, and then you could start to hear what was going on with the plants. So that in itself is kind of a quantitative analysis of something that's more qualitative, and we don't really understand what we're looking at yet when we look at that. We just see excitation in a plant during certain circumstances, but we're not sure what they're saying.
Yeah, what sort of patterns would you say? Are you pulling anything that you're sort of piecing together a theory about it, or is it just something that makes you appreciate that nature is more intelligent than we conceive of, maybe.
Well, what I was interested in is I was interested in Lawrence's work. Eventually, L. George Lawrence would go on to create artificial plant-like substances that he would call biosensors that would receive and transmit signals, and they could be over vast distances. But what he was looking for was some form of communication that was superluminal. And the reason for that is he was very interested, because he lived with George Van Tassel out at Giant Rock for a number of years. He lived underneath Giant Rock and had a laboratory there. And George Van Tassel was a flying saucer guy from the 50s. And so there was all of this talk about communicating with E.T. And if we were really going to communicate with E.T., which is it's a very good idea, is that we would have to communicate at superluminal speeds, or almost instantaneous, or something that's more longitudinal in waveform than transverse in waveform, because otherwise our communications would take, you know, thousands of years to reach one another. And that's not a viable form of communication. So L. George Lawrence was looking into a biological form of communication that actually happened on a more instantaneous, it was a more instantaneous connection, which would make sense. If you're going to communicate with somebody 20,000 light years away, you've got to have some other medium of communication. But the only problem that I had with that was that L. George Lawrence felt that he was getting intelligent signals from Ursa Major, and I really couldn't find any corroborating evidence for that, that he was pointing the apparatus that he had built at Ursa Major, but who's to say that he wasn't getting some kind of communication in between the space of his apparatus and Ursa Major. I mean, there wasn't anything really concrete there, but it was still a very interesting avenue of experimentation. And that's really what I kept pursuing. Then I got, you know, I got introduced to the work of Terence McKenna, and he starts talking about mushrooms and the things that he's saying about them as, you know, having an extraterrestrial origin. And I thought, wow, you know, maybe there's something that should be explored. And I started, instead of plants, I started hooking up my apparatus to mushrooms, and I'm still working on that research, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Sorry, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that was going to be my next question, because John had told me a little bit about that. Maybe if you could explain what you're doing and what you found and what you think.
Well, what I've found so far, and I've only released one recording of it. It was the first recording I did. I was blown away by it. But anything in the mushroom category so far has just absolutely been incredibly sensitive. And I did a show years ago on the Discovery Channel. It was the Sci-Fi Channel, and they came out and they filmed me doing the research on plants, but they inserted this footage of a botanist telling them that, well, what I was doing was I was simply torturing the plant. Mm-hmm. And because I had a clamp with electrodes on the leaf of a plant and it was damaging the leaf, and there were certain voltages that were coming out of the leaf because of the damage that was being done to it. Well, with the mushroom, we have the electrodes are simply placed on the mushroom. There's no clamping involved whatsoever, because you would be damaging it, but we're getting incredible information out of it. And that's about as far as I can go, because I'm working on an article on it right now. And I want to kind of save some of that for the article.
Okay. I suppose when John told me about it, it seemed to me that, I guess you're talking about just straight up any kind of mushroom, or is it strictly the psychedelic kind of mushroom?
No, not any kind.
Okay. Because I was wondering, just because with the mushroom experience and DMT, they talk about this sort of sound, and I can personally verify this incredible, overwhelming kind of sound or buzz experience that you experience. Mm-hmm. And my question was kind of foiled by hearing that you were talking about that. But I don't know if you have any experience with that yourself. I find it very interesting. A lot of music these days, particularly electronic experimental music, seems to me to be sort of recreating the sound in a way. It's almost an impossible sort of rhythm that's like hard to describe, put into words, but like notes come on top of notes and blazingly fast. It's almost like a fractalized sound. And I just wondered maybe if you have any ideas on that.
I never experienced it in that particular way. And I was always looking for that experience, but I can tell you this. It was a long time ago. I was on doing some experimentation with psilocybin cubensis, and I listened to a piece of music by Dmitri Shostakovich, who I would probably not listen to ever in any other circumstance, but I listened to it. And what I got from the piece of music, that time absolutely stood still, and I heard the entire piece of music as a whole within 1 second. And there you go. That's why I've been trying to recreate that experience. And, sure. And, you know, some of those things that we experience with hallucinogens, we can't take back with us. Sure. Or at least we try, though.
Sure. And I don't know if you're familiar much with Kenneth Grant, the British occultist, but he wrote a lot, and he would often mention how this overlap between, in these sort of occult settings, people would mention the buzz and associated with the archetype, the bee, and this humming sound, and that this was some indication of being in the presence of the old ones in this the Lovecraftian sense. And that sort of connection, also people report that with like UFO experiences. It's this sort of the buzz that happens in a lot of reports, particularly in like John Keel's work. And so, yeah, I don't know if I have a question.
I think it's a time distortion effect because we're so accustomed to time in its linear fashion and it's aging and it's doing this. And really what happens is that, I mean, it's like Lovecraft. You mentioned Lovecraft and Dreams in the Witch House or The Music of Eric Zahn, where you've got time distortion effects happening there. And they're either from music or they're from the architecture of the building or what have you. But that thing that's happening right there is distorting our perception of time, and it all becomes now, and there is no future and there is no past, and everything that we know is encompassed right now. There's no linear thing going on whatsoever. And it's hard to grasp that. And that to me is, you know, it's not my idea. It's other people have mentioned it is the secret to actual time travel, because there is no time.
Yes.
I mean, that might sound odd, but I mean, a lot of people have proposed that. And
I understand. It makes sense to me. Well, it's definitely time is not what we think. I mean, it's pretty elementary to say like from the fourth dimension or a higher modality, you would see time as a whole, as one. And the people like to compare it to like a vinyl record where, you know, wherever the needle lays, it's all there, but we're just kind of experiencing it on a track sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, because that's our concept of time. It has to move from point A to point B.
Right.
When you start to discover, well, for instance, projective geometry or hyperbolic geometry, and how, for instance, you understand the difference between Euclidean geometry and projective geometry. With Euclidean geometry, you have a point, you have 2 points, forms a line, you have 3 points, form a plane, but you have no position in space because you've done this from a point-centric viewpoint. When you talk about projective geometry, you have a plane at infinity. You add another plane, now you've got a line at infinity, and you add another plane, and you've created the point. But what you have, because it's from the periphery, is you're able to create location in space. And the great thing about that is the geometry of the future and of time. And certainly you can combine the Euclidean geometry with non-Euclidean geometry or projective geometry. And I really believe that that's another stepping stone to being able to create free energy. But we really haven't arrived there yet. We've got some of the concepts down. If you want to read about projective geometry, anything by Olive Witcher and George Adams is fantastic.
I'll look into that.
It's funny you brought up bees, because I was just not too long ago reading P.D. Uspensky's A New Model of the Universe, and he was talking about evolution, and he conceived of the idea that bees used to be the size of men and lived like men, and made a moral choice or value choice or however you want to conceive of it, but their choice drove them towards being like a hive mind. And then they shrank down in size. And so, Alex, when you talk to them like the old ones, I'm like, okay, well, what if bees are really, really beyond old? And that's how they used to be. That's just one of my weirder, I'll entertain this moments. But I like Uspensky, and he was one of the original like scientific occultists. So I have a lot of respect for him besides him being off.
Yeah, I was always more of a Gurdjieff guy, but I like that idea. I think they're just ready to leave this planet at this point too. It's pretty obvious. But it was funny. I was actually, we all have to do certain things during the day, and I was supposed to mow the lawn today. And I look out at the lawn, and my lawn is, the neighbors are just appalled and horrified because it's growing. And, but I looked out at the lawn today, and I saw about 30 bumblebees in the clover. And I said, you know what? Screw this. I'm not taking their clover away.
Nice.
So the neighbors are going to have to deal. Because I'm saving bees. So I don't know. That didn't really have anything to do with it, but that was.
I had a similar experience, actually. We left a patch of our yard just to grow kind of wildly with wildflowers that we planted, and it got really out of hand, but we were like, oh, is this too much? And then we saw all these bees, and they're like, well, they're happy. So, and I I wanted to point out the interesting synchronicity of Captain Beefheart and the bee in there that just made me in full circle there.
So just B.
Yes. B heart. I don't know.
Right.
That's a whole different subject.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of the universe as like an attractor space. And within that attractor space, it's like a spectrum of, I guess, harmonics. I don't know if that's really the right word, but harmonics compose a pure tone.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of the universe that way, it's like you have all these different octaves probably below us and above us. And in that sense, I mean, standard physics, I know certain people don't like pulling in standard physics to these alternative models, but for what it's worth, that concept is already there in a lot of ways. They just don't admit to any meaning behind it because they have to sort of toe the, whatever the rational line is nowadays.
Was it Bohr's law that stated that when you looked at our solar system, there are certain intervallic relationships that related to the diatonic scale, but what's happening there is we're looking at it from Western musical academia, which says that, okay, so we have a diatonic scale that has 8 tones in it. We have a chromatic scale that has 12 tones in it that are between, that consist of the octave. When we go to the east, that goes away. And the interval relationships are anything goes between the octave. So the octave is really the only thing, the only constant. Because you can put any number of tones in between the octave, whatever you want, it will be infinite. So even with a simple 22 tone scale, the Arabic Maqamat would be something that would not fit in with any of this Western ideology as far as harmonics are concerned and harmonics of the universe are concerned. If we relate it to our construct of Western music, then yeah, sure, it can make sense. But when we step outside of Western music and look at other cultures and the music that they've created, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So how do we say that's like amazing? Look, the harmonics fit the pattern of the solar system or whatever. Well, only in Western music, sorry.
Do you conceive of certain temples or cathedrals or whatnot, basically giant musical instruments that people used to use them to reach ecstatic states, and sometimes maybe still do, but not like they used to? I don't know if you know who Richard Merrick is, but I know you mentioned sacred spaces in the book, and I didn't know if you touched on that much.
No, I'm not sure I know who that is. I do completely agree with that I think that these, you know, like the great cathedrals were built for that specific purpose and built in such a way that they naturally resonated certain energies, you know, or if you will, the energy of God to the people who entered them. Even just looking at it from the outside, I mean, I think they're amazing. I've been to several of the cathedrals and it's unbelievable. I don't think that technology could be recreated today.
I mean, that ties back into some, I guess, conspiratorial stuff about what's going on there, but in a lot of ways, as far as I view those being part of any kind of lineage or something like that, it's, I think certain people know what they're really used for, and nowadays no one knows the value of anything. So these things can be hidden in plain sight, and they're these actually incredible testaments to scientific thinking. It just depends on what end you put it towards. So they just did it to reach ecstatic states, and now we don't know what we're doing, so we build toxic technology, and we don't know what we're doing with it, or for what purpose. Right. It's just what to turn the world into a garbage dump, basically.
Well, I was just going to say the great John Michel had an amazing wealth of knowledge on that topic that I couldn't even come close to. That's what really opened me up to the whole idea of sacred sites and ley lines and how these things were placed and the architecture that went into them. And it was really all John Michel's work that brought me to that.
Well, do you think these things, it was just purely a synchronistic coincidence that they all ended up aligned perfectly? Do you think everyone is sort of like connected, whatever that means? There's a lot of different ways to think about it. Is it like a longitudinal festering like kind of phenomenon that just everything is getting down where it's supposed to be and it's just self-organizing, so everyone has different motives, but it just ends up that way? Or what do you
think? Well, there are no coincidences. So it didn't just end up that way. And there was certainly...
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. It's obvious that there were still some people, if you will, that understood some of the ancient, even further back technologies that were still around in the 12th and 13th century in order to be able to create cathedrals. You know, going forward, there were some other people that created some pretty amazing things. And you know, I mentioned Coral Castle and Edward Leedskalin before, and it's a pretty amazing place, but it really doesn't come close. And granted, he was one guy who created it, but it doesn't come close to the grandeur of a Gothic cathedral, in my opinion. And so he may have had some inkling. I mean, you know, he even stated in his book, Magnetic Current, I know the secrets of how the pyramids were built and Stonehenge and whatever. I recently got a video from a guy named Wally Wallington. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Well, he shows how to do this stuff all by yourself. And he shows it on this video, and he's been doing it for a long time, and he's erected 30-ton blocks of stone and raised them up with a simple pulley and a come-along, and he's figured out a number of things with leverage. He can't mathematically explain it to you, but he can do it, and he does it on the video, and he repeats it, and he's just a simple farmer guy. And so he's not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. So... some people have been handed down certain secrets, and however they got them, it's anybody's guess, but some of that stuff is still around. And not much of it's left, but some of that knowledge is still around.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I try to think of if there's a consensus agreement what they were used to be used for, if people would even take advantage of it anyway, because everyone would just shrug their shoulders, I guess, and be like, so what? What am I going to use it for? We're always thinking about how can we exploit this technology instead of just appreciating something for what it is. And this is the most obvious answer to me. And
that's a great point that you bring up, is that we're always, you know, or at least a lot of humans are looking to exploit whatever they can with any kind of technology. And you see it in the alternative fields as well. I mean, you see it all over the place, but I mean, just accepting it for what it is, like you said, and enjoying it and experiencing it. Maybe everybody just needs to do more mushrooms.
Word.
Sometimes, yes, sure.
Consult your physician on that one.
Well, I think this is a good way of concluding here. Thanks for having me, and it's been a really nice discussion.
It's been fun. I hope I made some sense. You know, you never know when you're talking about all these things that if you're making any sense whatsoever until you listen to it later on.
Sir, are you up to anything besides the book that you don't want to say too much about? Or is there anything else that you're contemplating, or where you play music nowadays, and how can people, I guess, find you?
Well, you can always go to my website, michaeltheroux.com. Usually I update. I haven't updated it in a while. I haven't had too much to say. I've been really busy playing a lot of music, but I'm also working on a book, and it's a kind of a homage to Gurdjieff in a sense, because he wrote the book Meetings with Remarkable Men. In this case, the title of my book is Meetings with Remarkable Kooks. And I'm one of those kooks. So, it's a story of my experience. It's kind of like a memoir of my experiences of working with Borderland Sciences from 1986 to the year 2000 and all of the interesting people that I met. And it goes through quite a bit of material. That should be out hopefully this fall. And I'll put a notification on the website, but it covers an enormous amount of material and digs into all of the people that we were discussing tonight. So it doesn't paint anybody in a bad light. It just says that this is kind of where we've entered a different realm of thinking. And I guess it's more of a memoir of that, you know, meeting all of these people and being a part of that. So
real quickly, this is sort of, I don't know if you know this, but about Gurdjieff, that he was a musician, and I don't know if you've heard any of his compositions.
I had the tape of his harmonium compositions.
Yeah, a friend of mine, and well, this label in Portland just actually put out a vinyl edition of that, if you're still a record person. But
yes, I am.
Worth tracking down.
I love that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I'll have to look that up, or if you have a link or something.
Yeah,
that
I could send you a link or something to it.
Yeah.
The only objection I have against Gurdjieff, otherwise I really like him a lot, and I love I guess it's P.D. Uspensky's book, but it's basically Gurdjieff's, all his teachings. And
yeah,
that was In Search of the Miraculous. And yeah, similar to other theorists and whatever, I don't see eye to eye with him on everything, but he is a really interesting psychologist. I'd say some of it went a little overboard at the end when he started like ditching people regularly and like kind of being weird. Otherwise, he was really cool. And I encourage everyone to read him or read Uspensky's interpretation of what he said, either way.
Yeah, Uspensky's interpretation of what Gurdjieff said was probably a better introduction than you will get from reading about Gurdjieff specifically. I mean, he used to do some crazy things, like he would, you know, get a bunch of his students together and make them drink vodka until they got shit-faced and smoke cigars and then recite his own poetry. And he just had a grand time with these people. And then other times, you know, was that a specific lesson to be learned? Because other times he was very, you know, very to the point with his teachings. And then he would do these crazy things. So I don't know. He's quite a character.
Yeah, he's definitely worth reading in that regard. So,
yeah.
And even his theory had like a lot of music in it. So that's also, I mean, it was hard for me to keep track of after a while, and I kind of didn't. But I, you know, it embedded in my mind that, okay, he's drawing on a really interesting synthesis here. And it's just, I never see eye to eye with anybody completely. So I just appreciate the effort.
Yep, nor do I.
All right, Michael, so thanks again for taking the time tonight.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune into our other SyncBook Radio programs, including 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Pentimental, Synchronize, Sync Quick News, as well as our most recent editions, Fine Just Fine and Hypnosis. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.